Hi, everyone. Welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Nick Ruocrow.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today we have a really special episode. We'll be talking about possibly the most viewed film in film history, a movie that a lot of people find dearly beloved. It's The Wizard of Oz. I can't really call it Victor Fleming's The Wizard of Oz, so we will get into lots of production history, all of our usual content, talking about our favorite scenes, and even getting to some listener questions at the end. So I'm excited about this one today.
Yeah, me too. And I was trying to think, is this the biggest movie we've ever covered? I mean, we've done The Godfather, Casablanca. But this one, that fact that you shared, that this might be the most viewed film of all time, The Wizard of Oz has a prominent place in pop culture that we can talk about too, and just absolutely wild production details and trivia. It feels like one of those movies where it's a miracle that it actually exists. And as I was doing research and prep for this episode, came across the fact that it's on a dozen or so AFI lists of, you know, greatest movies, number six on the AFI 100, two songs, including the number one song from a movie, Over the Rainbow, which almost didn't make it in the movie because Louis B. Mayer didn't want it. And it was funny when we were watching just on that little piece of trivia. So Louis B. Mayer, he didn't want Over the Rainbow to be in the movie because he thought it prolonged the period when they're in Kansas and he wanted to get to Oz. And I tend to agree with him that I think we are there a little bit too long, but I obviously would not cut the song. I think that's one of those key pieces of film history and film trivia. It's just really interesting. Wicked Witch of the West, number four on the heroes and villains list. So this is a movie that I feel like there's a lot of pressure, I think, in how we talk about it, but I think we'll mostly just be having a fun conversation about how we feel about the movie and really its place in film history.
Yeah, there's so much lore surrounding this film, and it's an inspiration for so many movies since then. So we're also celebrating the film's 85th anniversary, which is a part of that, but some of the things that you're mentioning, like trying to cut the song or even just The Wicked Witch of the West, has to do with how kids see this film, and that this movie back then was seen as a sort of children's film, or trying to get them to want to see this movie. And this came 2 years after Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which did very well. So that's what really inspired this movie to come about at that time. There were previous iterations of The Wizard of Oz that didn't do well. And so this just blasted those out of the water. Eventually, it did take some time. But, you know, getting back to the kids part of it all, is that this really wasn't, to me, in trying to think back of how this movie has influenced me, wasn't a big part of my childhood. I think maybe I had seen it a few times, and I still have the version of the book that I had from growing up, but this rewatch was probably my first in many, many years, to a point that I thought we really like moved on from Kansas very quickly, and I realized that that wasn't the case. I'm like, 20 minutes in, we are just now getting to Oz, and I'm like, okay, let's go. Let's speed this up a little bit. And I can talk about, you know, how a little bit of that sequence changed for me, you know, viewing that as I am now. But it is interesting that it didn't really have that effect on me as a kid, that, you know, this is like the most important movie to me, or anything super hyperbolic in that sense. It's not that I don't like it, but I'm curious of what your relationship is to this movie, or how it had a different influence on you throughout the years.
You know what? It's funny you say that, because we're a little similar in that way. This was not the staple growing up. I did really like it a lot as a child, and was scared of the flying monkeys, like I know I've mentioned to you before, and I was absolutely obsessed with The Wicked Witch of the West. Fun fact, not Glinda. I just like loved everything about The Wicked Witch of the West. So I think The Wizard of Oz was something that was there, but it was never one of my movies that I returned to over and over and over again as a child, and that I would say influenced the way that I saw film, because for me, those movies were the original hand-drawn Disney movies, Sleeping Beauty, 101 Dalmatians. Those were, I think, my early films that I was really, really into. And then Golden Age of Hollywood movies, they were musicals that came a little bit later. Mary Poppins, The Sound of Music, those were the musicals of my childhood. So I remember being very dazzled by The Wizard of Oz, but it wasn't something that was on repeat in our house growing up. Like, I think it is for a lot of families and a lot of kids. So much so that people have Wizard of Oz memorabilia and, you know, are all of these characters for Halloween growing up. And that was just not my experience. But it also is listed time and time again on certain filmmakers' lists as, you know, this is the movie that changed the way I watched movies forever. Noah Baumbach is one of them. Greta Gerwig is one of them. So it does come up and it makes a lot of sense when you hear certain filmmakers reference it. But for me, that did make it more interesting to watch it this time as an adult. I also hadn't watched it in years, and I was really blown away by it. But I think for reasons that are both expected and unexpected with what I like about film and film history. So let's get right into it. And then I think we can talk more about scenes and more about this relationship that we have with the movie. But a description, not that anyone needs it. I feel like everyone is probably so familiar with this movie, but young Dorothy Gale and her dog Toto are swept away by a tornado from their Kansas farm to the magical land of Oz and embark on a quest with three new friends to see the wizard, who can return her to her home and fulfill the other's wishes. This was directed by Victor Fleming. Little asterisk on that. We will talk about that, how there were many people involved in this production. It had many directors and stars. Judy Garland, Frank Morgan, Billy Burke, Ray Bolger, Burt Lair, Jack Haley, Margaret Hamilton, and Terry, the Cairn Terrier, who plays Toto. We always have to give the animals credit. This won two competitive Oscars for Music Original Song for Over the Rainbow and Music Original Score. It also received three other nominations for Picture, Art Direction, and Special Effects. And Judy Garland also won the Honorary Juvenile Award, which she also shared with her performance in Babes in Arms. I think picking up where we left off, how did you feel on this watch? Like, how did it change for you? How did you think about it this time, not having seen it in a really long time?
I think the magic of it all was still there. It's very much based in fantasy, and I picked up on that from the framing of the Kansas sequences and her coming back home and waking up. And then the biggest thing to me that I never recognized when I was young, which again is interesting that they focused on making some of these apparent, which I think are more for adults, but it's that the characters from Kansas reprise their roles in her dreamlike Oz reality in different ways. So you have the like wicked Miss Gulch from Kansas who wants to take away Toto because he bit her once or whatever it was, and Toto escapes. And then she, Margaret Hamilton, becomes the Wicked Witch of the West in Oz. And she is again trying to kill Dorothy and Toto and your little dog too. And that's the plot of that whole new reality for her. So I thought that was really interesting how they frame this story that is a lot more detailed than I had known it to be as a kid. The only like nostalgic part of this movie to me, which was interesting, that when I saw it, I was like, oh, this is weird. I remember and recognize this, is when the Tin Man, the Lion, and the Scarecrow are dressed up in the very end in those guard clothes after they switch in and they're running up the stairs and they're hacking at the door. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, this is so familiar. But again, I hadn't seen this in 15, 20 years at least.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just a weird, like, costume or set piece that my mind picked up on. I would say it's still not one of my, like, favorite movies of all time. I think mm-hmm. it's spectacularly beautiful, being one of these really early instances of Technicolor, and reading about how, for parts of it, they took so much time trying to figure out hues of different colors that they would use, like the Yellow Brick Road. But I think overall it's interesting. You know, it does move very fast, except for that opening Kansas piece, I would say. And they really wanted to cut it down. At the time, it was about 2 hours before they released it, and they knew they had to cut some because movies at the time were a lot shorter. So I think it's mm-hmm. like 100 minutes, and it plays mostly very well. They keep moving. She keeps meeting new characters, and they sing. And I would say the opening 6 or 7 songs are just perfect. No notes. And then I think as we move into the film and they sing their own bits, I kind of fall off. Like when the lion has his own moment in the second act, I'm like, okay, we probably could have cut this. Definitely instead of Over the Rainbow, which comes very early in the movie. That was another part that surprised me. So lots of rambling there. But my initial thoughts, I would say, all of the iconic moments, I think, stand out to me as they should and as they do to most people. But what about you? How do you view the movie, or did you like it more than you think you did as a kid?
I did. I actually really, really loved it on this watch. I agree with you about the Cowardly Lion and that song. I was very tempted to just hit the little skip on my remote as that scene was coming up, and that has not changed since I was a child. That character, I think all three of them, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Lion, I'm less interested in them than I am in the witches. Surprise, surprise. I think really floored by it, especially because, you know, we're doing this episode, yes, to celebrate the 85th anniversary, but also with Wicked coming up, pairing it with that. We'll have a review of that later this month. But, you know, with Wicked, watching the trailer, and I've only seen the trailer, I haven't seen the film yet, so this is just a judgment on the early stills and images that we have. It just looks so CGI heavy. And I know that they built real sets for it, and I'm sure that the production design is really beautiful, but there is something about watching a movie from the 30s and realizing they were so inventive back then because they had to be. You know, creating the tornado out of a sock, that would never be done today because they have all of the technology to try to make it look perfect. And back then, they didn't have those resources, so they had to be really creative, and it just makes the film better. Putting Jell-O powder on those horses,
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't happen today either. There are certain things that just, I think now, because we rely so much on technology, the films end up looking worse somehow than the ones that were made back then. And The Wizard of Oz is a perfect example of that because it is this dazzling Technicolor dream, really. It's so beautiful, and that juxtaposition of Kansas being those sepia tones, everything is khaki and brown, and then you go to the Emerald City and it's just this pop of every color you could ever want to see. There's something so striking about that, and I think just really inspiring as a movie watcher, knowing that with everything they have today, they could never do it like this. And there's a reason why the movie has stuck around as long as it has and has become so iconic. And I think the story is also really smart because they pack so much in. It's very efficient storytelling with the runtime. So much happens. You think about today, if they tried to make a story like this, I mean, one, Wicked Part One is 2 hours and 40 minutes, and that's just part one. But I think they would just, you know, stretch it out. We'd have to have backstory. And we do have backstory for Dorothy, really, in that we see her start in Kansas and go into this dream sequence. But it's so quick. We know exactly what every character wants. We know what they need. We know how they're going to get it. We know the relationships between characters in really smart, savvy ways. And I think that's what makes this such an easy watch. Also, Judy Garland's performance. She's just one of the greatest musical performers that we have. It is kind of funny. I was going to ask you this. How old do you think Dorothy is supposed to be? Because this always throws me when I watch it, and I try to just suspend my disbelief and think, you know, this is made another time.
Mm-hmm.
But it always makes me laugh thinking about how she's supposed to be a little girl.
Like, her filming this when she was 16, I feel like that's a perfectly fine age to be having this adventure. And reading that even critics were upset with that she was so, quote unquote, old for this. I'm like, what tiny little girl is going to be waltzing through a forest alone? And I'm like, I don't know, she's supposed to be 12 or younger?
I think she's supposed to be around 11 or around, like, around there, somewhere in there from what I have read. And I think it's also just hard because 16-year-olds in the 30s looked 30 to us watching today. I always think that when I watch It's a Wonderful Life and Mary is graduating from high school. I'm like, I don't even look like this now. I don't understand how you're such a glamorous 18-year-old. But yeah, it's just a funny thing. But I think she is really good in the role. I mean, mm-hmm. It is, again, one of the most iconic roles. And that's largely due to her vocal performance in these songs. But I also like that she got the advice early on to not play it up too big, which makes me wonder actually how big she was going in the first place. But I love her in this, and really the Margaret Hamilton performance mm-hmm. as well, which we have a fun fact about her, which I'm excited to share, from our friend Bennett, who said, please talk about how Margaret Hamilton was part of the Cleveland theater scene and played bridge with my grandma as a member of the Shaker Heights Society.
That is wild. I saw that she was born in Cleveland. That. I'm like, okay, very cool. But that Bennett's family knew her is just mm-hmm. out of this world.
I love the Cleveland theater connections. I always think of Joel Grey from Cabaret, too. Mm-hmm. So much great talent comes from Ohio.
Lots of Ohioans.
Did you have any favorite scenes that you really enjoyed this time around watching it?
Well, you mentioned the sepia tones of Kansas and this really bright, saturated color of Oz. And I think that distinction, which comes about in one take, it is cut to show Dorothy's reaction as she comes through the door of the house. So this is when the house lands in Oz and she opens the door to go outside and she sees Munchkin Land, and the camera goes through the door, and then it's this crane shot where we see all of Munchkin Land. We see the flowers and their little village and the river with the bridge, and then it circles back around to Dorothy leaving the house from Kansas. And I think that shot is probably the best shot that we have up until this point in time. And it's definitely one of the most iconic in film history.
It's why Damien Chazelle put it in Babylon.
At
I just remember
point?
The last time,
oh God.
The last time I had seen that shot, I was thinking about it, and it was the ending of Babylon in the montage.
Well, it was much more effective here, I will say. And I love that scene because, again, that's very early in the film, and the progression of songs from Over the Rainbow to, there's another song in between, but Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, she's in Munchkin Land. And then they're like, great, go see the wizard, he's in Oz, follow the yellow brick road. And I love how she waltzes to the beat of the song along the road. That just shows that Garland was on beat. She knew what she was doing. So I very much love that. And then she meets the Scarecrow, If I Only Had a Brain. And then the first rendition of We're Off to See the Wizard. And it's just perfect storytelling. I love all of those scenes, which blend together really well. Going back a little bit, because you mentioned last time, you're like, I thought this was really scary as a kid, and I didn't really know which point. And in watching the movie, I was going to ask you. So you already revealed to us, but I was curious. Mm-hmm. I was like, is it the Munchkins? Is it the Wicked Witch? is it the wizard? Because he's very scary. I love also that connection, because the Wicked Witch of the West comes when Glinda's there and we still haven't left on the Yellow Brick Road. And we have that plume of reddish, like pink orange smoke, which is how she comes and goes and disappears. And then once we meet the wizard for the first time, we have that same colored smoke. So I love that connection where it's like, we don't know if we can trust the wizard yet, because he's also very scary and almost evil looking with that projection of his like green face, which is again, a connection to the Wicked Witch. So I feel like I was scared of something when I was young, but I don't remember what. And then you said it was the monkey. So it's like, there are multiple reasons to be scared of this as a kid, not just the Wicked Witch, which they ended up cutting many of her scenes because they were worried she'd be too scary. So were there any other elements that you thought were kind of frightening?
Honestly, like, I thought the lion was scarier than the witch as a kid. I loved witches, though. Like, I was never scared of witches. I was a witch every year for Halloween for a really long time. So I loved her and like where she lived, and I thought that was so cool. Everything about that. Glinda, I didn't care as much. Just, I didn't love pink. I remember like wanting to, like, I remember liking her dress and her scepter, but wanting it to be a different color. I have not changed at all. I'm exactly the same, really. But I think it was really just the flying monkeys for me. Watching it again, though, I was thinking of, you know, things that would scare kids. The trees, they're walking through the forest, I think those would also scare kids. But there's something about the monkeys, it still sends a chill down my spine, especially as they're flying away and we have those shots of them flying. They're so effective, and they take me right back to how I felt about those monkeys when I was a little kid. The design is really good. I love those costumes. And again, like how they just swarm. They fly in a pack. So, yeah, I think that was the big scary thing. But as far as scenes go, I agree with you. Like, the beginning of the movie, as she's in Oz, it is complicated, because I remember always, even as a kid, feeling badly for the Wicked Witch of the West. I mean, her sister was killed by this house, and the girl who killed her sister took her shoes, and Glinda is trying to make it out like it's this, you know, oh, there's this evil witch and the Munchkins are singing and celebrating her death. And I don't know. So maybe Wicked is the movie for me. We'll see. But yeah, the way we move from song to song and have this sense of discovery along with Dorothy as she's meeting these characters, and she's just trying to make her way to the wizard to eventually get home. Every single piece of the set is perfect. These painted backdrops that we have. You have a fact about the specific gold on the Yellow Brick Road, of them choosing that color, and the way that the Emerald City looks in the distance, how it gleams, and when they're in that poppy field. Like, those moments, everything just looks so original and fresh. And it makes sense that they were inspired by Snow White here, because so much of it does feel like a fairy tale, or like you're watching that type of adventure film. But every piece of this just feels brand new and like something you've never seen up to that point. And that's always so exciting to watch.
About the flying monkeys, they also remind me of, and I think I mentioned this before, maybe briefly, a movie that was probably the scariest thing to me when I was younger. It's a movie from 1996 called Magic in the Mirror.
I agree. That also scared me as a kid.
It's like ducks, but it's that human-like face of the monkeys in this case, where you still feel like they're human in a way. And like when they pick her up and whisk her away, that is so scary. And even the lighting in these scenes, like it's darker in the forest. So, you know, it's just something ominous. And I also agree the trees are terrifying, especially when you can see it talking, throwing the apples. And probably the only other scene throughout the film that I'm really tied to is the ending of Toto escaping the castle when she's been taken. And then the Scarecrow, the Lion, and the Tin Man coming to rescue her, and then them all getting caught in this castle in that sequence. There are just probably 100 actors and extras in that moment. There were also hundreds of munchkins. And I didn't know that they were a real troupe of actors from Europe, and they were mostly Jewish. So again, this was 1938 when they filmed into 39, and they came to America and escaped the Nazis, which is not something I would have ever thought of. They don't really speak, partly in due to they didn't know English. And there were only two of them that had main speaking roles because they did know it. And it's just little things like that along the way of production that I found fascinating. Another one, like I mentioned with the plume of smoke with the witch, that there was a malfunction. And on the second take of her exit in Munchkinland, the fire came too soon and she had third degree burns. And
I saw this.
And she was
crazy
recuperating for 3 months. I'm like, if this happened today, there would just be the biggest lawsuit. It would, I feel like, never get made.
Yeah. They were in massive need of a legal and HR department. They needed, I mean, it would be too much work for anyone. But yeah, you hear these stories and it's just like one thing after another with this movie.
Yeah, maybe we get into all of the like bad things now, but it was partly in due to her having to wear copper makeup. I'm like, excuse me? Mm. And then along with that, we had the Tin Man originally wearing aluminum powder worn by Buddy Ebsen, but he was hospitalized. So they had to recast him with Jack Haley, who ended up wearing aluminum paste with a layer underneath to protect his skin. I'm like, okay, why didn't you do that in the first place? You had, even when Margaret Hamilton was out healing, that her stunt double was injured when they were filming the sequence of her riding the smoking broomstick. And it was just like, there's so much more. There's also abuse to Judy Garland, which really the last, I guess, reference to The Wizard of Oz that I knew was from the movie Judy. And when we covered that, but, you know, the references in that film to how she was treated and abused by everyone from Louis B. Mayer to Victor Fleming to even some of the munchkins.
I know.
To what they
I
made her do.
That.
It's just, there's so much. And then they used asbestos for the snow falling in the poppy field. I'm like, I have to step back and just like appreciate the film because all of this is insane.
I know, right? It's like we see the final product and its place in history, but looking at everything that happened on this set, like I said at the beginning, a miracle that it turned out the way that it did with all of the toxicity. And yeah, Judy Garland, I mean, she obviously faced so much pressure from Louis B. Mayer, from the studio, like putting a girl that young on the diet that they put her on too. During this movie, it's so terrible. And I think you can't really separate the movie from the history because so much of this history is, like, it's important, I think, to talk about in the context of the film and how movies were made at the time, especially at MGM. MGM has a reputation for mistreating their actors, for underpaying them. Toto, like Terry, the dog who played Toto, made more money than the actors who played the munchkins.
Mm-hmm. Like, what is Terry doing with this money?
Excellent performance. Can't wait till we get to our recasting question there. But yeah, this set is really, really something. But I think, like, overall, just thinking about the movie and how it looks and how it feels to watch it, it is something where I, after this watch, understand, I think, why so many people love it as much as they do and reference it as much as they do and want to make their own version of it, essentially. And again, in terms of the troubled production, I mean, a huge part of it too is that we had 6 directors who worked on The Wizard of Oz at different points: Norman Turok, Richard Thorpe, George Cukor, Mervyn LeRoy, Victor Fleming, and King Vidor. Victor Fleming ended up being the credited director on Gone with the Wind, which is funny. He left and then King Vidor took over and finished it.
Yeah, and them having even more screenwriters and like drafts of this movie, and certain writers like wrote the Kansas scenes and then others just finished different pages for the film, and none of them knew of each other writing these different drafts, which I thought was interesting, and that was something that happened a lot at the time. So it's just crazy again that this movie got made with one vision, because we see movies nowadays that feel like we had multiple people attached and we don't really know the history of it, but this doesn't feel like it had so many people and iterations attached to it, which is very surprising.
Right. It's chaos behind the scenes, perfect final product. It looks and feels and sounds so consistent. So it is just bizarre when you think about like, oh, this person had the idea for the dream sequence because they felt that people wouldn't believe it if it was just straight fantasy. And one person wanted to take all the magic out of it completely, which makes no sense. So yeah, it's surprising that the final product is as good as it is.
I read that at some point, and I think they had this throughout the test screenings too, and they took it out, but they wanted to like make it modern. So they had this song and sequence called The Jitterbug. And I'm like, excuse me, what? Like, we're in some, even at this point, like ahead of its time into the 50s or 60s. But please take all of that out and focus more on the book and just what that story included, which there were parts that ended up in the movie that weren't even in the script. Thankfully, that was more directly from the book. So just wild. Overall, maybe it was heavily storyboarded, or this was all like producers and Mayer coming back and making sure it was all aligned, but wild.
Yeah, it really is. I think, do you have anything else you want to cover about the movie before we move into listener questions?
No, I think I'm saving some of that too for this. So yeah, let's get right into those. We had two questions from Philip Bond. His first one is, would you give Garland the Oscar over Vivian Leigh? Like you mentioned, Gone with the Wind, just the big takeaway from the Oscars this year, taking Best Picture and Director and Actress in this case, would you switch her out?
Never. Absolutely not. You know how much I love Vivian Leigh. So Betty Davis was also up for Dark Victory. We had Irene Dunne for Love Affair, Greta Garbo for Ninotchka, and Greer Garson for Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Vivian Leigh in Gone with the Wind, I think, is one of our greatest Best Actress winners ever. So there's no way I'm taking the Oscar away from her.
I would like to nominate Judy Garland, though. It's a performance that we think of throughout film history. And it's like, this wasn't nominated, which is crazy. This is a good list of actresses. I mean, you don't get any better than these five names, which is maybe hard to switch out.
Bump Greer right out. She can go in supporting. That's a supporting performance. She doesn't need to be in lead. She's a lead because she's the new MGM girl. Mm-hmm. And I understand that, but she belongs in supporting.
Dark Victory, I was going to say, isn't one of the movies when I think of Betty Davis. But I think also that Judy was 16 and maybe they did want to put her in supporting just because she was so young. But again, I think it's a worthy performance. No, I wouldn't switch her out with Vivian Leigh either, but I would like to at least see her, because I think maybe five nominations is a little low for this kind of movie having the endurance that it has.
Yeah, I would have nominated Margaret Hamilton in supporting too.
It's like great.
Easily.
Yeah.
And then for the second question, the favorite pop culture reference to The Wizard of Oz, my favorite will always be the Pink Floyd thing, which feels so silly to talk about, but it's something where I remember hearing that idea of how you can pair The Dark Side of the Moon with The Wizard of Oz, and they sync up perfectly in certain parts. And it leans into this like very trippy thing with the movie and Pink Floyd, of course. So it's not totally answering the question, I think, in the way that you might think of it of, you know, where do we see Ruby Slippers or how do we talk about Kansas, things like that. But the Pink Floyd thing will always be my favorite.
Yeah, I started thinking of Wicked references and like memes, and I'm like, wait, that wasn't the question. I would probably say like some references in movies where in like Shrek 2, Donkey, when it's raining outside, is screaming, "I'm melting, I'm melting." So it's like a lot of references to quotes or things that happen, like in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, when the gargoyles are attacking the soldiers, one of them says, "Fly, my pretties, fly."
You know, my hot take about that movie is that I wish the gargoyles weren't there.
Really?
I know. Yeah, I know that they have to be because it's a kid's movie, but I just love the drama of the church and Claude Frollo and Esmeralda. Yeah. That anytime we're on the gargoyles, I just want them to move back to the adult problem in the room.
Yeah, it's the comedic relief of, yeah, the fantasy of Disney. I guess my favorite would be from Jumanji, which is a movie that I watched a lot growing up and that I really liked. When the monkeys are attacking in the city, they look into the window of the electronics store and they see a scene from Wizard of Oz when the flying monkeys are attacking the Scarecrow and they take Dorothy and then they run in and loot the store and they bring out all of these electronics. So it motivates them. So I think that's a good one because it's also very quick and it's a little harder to notice.
Jumanji, another movie that terrified me as a child.
Yes.
But that I watched all the time.
And then Philip's last question was, why did the film last so long in the public consciousness?
This is tricky too. I think this really was lightning in a bottle, right? So much of it, I think, is because of the fact that it didn't make a profit for MGM, but then when they re-released it on CBS in 1956, that reintroduction to the public really worked. I think the timing of that is really smart, but the fact that it's had such staying power, I think, is because it's a movie that really appeals to all ages. It's a really simple story too, but told in a really dazzling way. It works to capture people really any time in their life and also at any point in their cinema history or like film going journey, really. So I think that's part of it. And yeah, but everything, I mean, if you think about like the costumes and the references, like you were mentioning, it really has had such long staying power.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, mostly because of those re-releases. It's a movie that throughout time, people have appreciated as a kid, as an adult. This was MGM's most expensive film at the time, and it didn't even turn a profit until the 1949 re-release, then only having made $4.5 million. So it was, I think, those releases throughout time in 55, in 89, and then through today that not only has the box office increased to 30 million, but I think it's reintroduced people to it and just found new audiences to also appreciate the film for, again, I think a movie from 1939.
Our next question comes from Josh Parham. Given the production had multiple directors working on it, if you could pick another filmmaker from that era to officially direct the film with their own adulterated version, who would you pick?
So my initial choice, and I didn't know this at the time, I was confusing my film history of Gone with the Wind with this, was George Cukor, because I think he's the one, he later makes My Fair Lady, and I think a lot of those creative decisions and backdrops and dance numbers and all of that magic is most like The Wizard of Oz and something that could have been made at the time. There are a lot of directors that I just don't think make the same movie, like Howard Hawks, who is iconic, and I just watched Bringing Up Baby, but he would make it too talky. So there are elements that I don't think that would work as well. I jokingly wrote down John Ford because we just talked about him. And I wonder how that would work out. I think my second best option would be Frank Capra, who we've also talked about here, but I think he has that everlasting touch to cinema that I think could work. George Cukor didn't actually shoot any scenes because he had to leave for Gone with the Wind in November of 1938, but he did act as creative advisor on the film after he left. So he does have some touches, I think, in the decisions. I think his initial decision was to make Dorothy blonde, which would have been totally different. But yeah, I think, again, just all of the hands playing into this, but I think he would be my number one. What about you?
Yeah, I think of the directors there, he would definitely be my number one. He was also, I mean, he was so instrumental in everything with Judy Garland, too, and just the types of films that he makes, it does make sense. Yeah, I was trying to think, and it's hard because I was like, I don't know, I thought, like, Ernst Lubitsch, could he do it? No. I mean, his movies are so romantic, but they're so, you know, I think he could lean into certain things from it and certain comedic moments, but his movies are just so adult, mm-hmm. really. And so I was trying to think a little bit more, and I honestly was just trying to think of, okay, whose version of this would be the most interesting? And I landed on Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, my God. See, he was an immediate no for me. That is so surprising.
I get why he would be an immediate no. And I think, like, it's a completely, completely different movie. But it would just be one that I would be curious to see.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it would be a lot darker and meaner. And I just am curious what he would do with it. It wouldn't be a musical like it is. It wouldn't have that same feel, but there's something that I would be curious to see there.
He would keep the whimsy, I think. So there's, like, movement. But, yeah, mm-hmm. interesting.
And kids love his movies. That's the other thing, too. But I do feel like it would have been Q-Core if we stuck with who was there.
Yeah. And then we had another question from Heather Stewart saying, obviously, it shouldn't be remade, but if The Wizard of Oz were to be remade today, who are you casting in the main roles? Sadly, I think Messi is too big to play Toto.
I loved that so much. We love Messi. For Dorothy, I have Julia Butters from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Trying to think of 11-year-old actors, like you said earlier, I'm like, I don't know anybody that young or someone who is starting out that will be around later on. But I went with Rachel Zegler.
That's fair.
That's our Snow White connection, which made me cringe a little bit. But she has the voice. She can dance. She's in Romeo and Juliet right now on Broadway. It's just, she can do it. And I think she has the look for it, too.
I think she does, too. So for my scarecrow, I have Mike Feist.
Do you have, like, other hot actors in there as well? Are those your three people to try to make them not scary?
Well, I do have a hot actor for the Tin Man, Colman Domingo.
That's,
I think he could be really
one.
Good.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I feel like he and Mike Feist can also sing. So I was trying to think of, like, who I could see in the part. Colman Domingo is very tall.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine him in that role. Mike Feist, you know, the Midwestern-ness of it all. I could see him being the scarecrow. And then my lion, I picked Jack Black.
Oh my God, wait. I thought of Jack Black and I'm like, he should be in here somewhere. And I think I did land on the lion probably. But I thought of School of Rock and I was trying to think of people that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm. For The Wicked Witch of the West, I had Anne Hathaway.
That's
because
a good
I
one.
Want her to have a new witch project that isn't Robert Zemeckis's
right.
The Witches.
I'm like, ooh. Not a great reference that we have. With The Wicked Witch, I thought of Nicole Kidman. And the problem with this, too, was like, we have Wicked coming and those actors, and I was trying not to repeat some of them. Like, I thought of Jeff Goldblum, maybe, for the Scarecrow. I think that would still work. And then I was like, you know who we have to have in this movie? Willem Dafoe. He had to come back at some point. But I'm like, where do we put him? Is he the wizard? Maybe. But I also thought of him as the lion, which is just also absurd. So I don't really know.
I love Willem Dafoe as the wizard. I think that's really fun. I really like that idea. And for Glinda, I also had Amanda Seyfried.
Oh, that's a good one. I have Carrie Coon, or kind of as a joke, Gwyneth Paltrow, because I think she would also love that.
Wait, that's so funny.
But, you know, thinking of Wicked, but also of, like, Into the Woods, and we already had Meryl as this witch-like mm-hmm. figure, so Wicked Witch, I didn't want to put her in there. But I also thought of, like, Angela Bassett or Viola Davis, who I think can play evil, but also add this humane quality, mm-hmm. which is really what they're getting at, and why we have Wicked also is, you know, giving her backstory. So I think either of them would also be really good at that kind of character.
And I have a controversial one for Toto.
Okay.
So I know we can't go with messy, but I'm going to make Toto a cat in my version. Ooh. And I'm going to cast King, the Maine Coon cat from Ripley, the Netflix limited series. Mm. This is like the most gorgeous cat you'll ever see. And he has like similar fur or like a similar look and coloring to Toto. Uh-huh. So I would go with Toto okay. the cat.
I like that. I was also trying to think of like, oh, what if we gender swap some of these roles or what? But
mm-hmm.
did you have any wizard replacements?
I didn't have anyone for the wizard. I like your Willem Dafoe pick, though.
Okay. My other option was Jeff Bridges, who I think is also like comical, but a little like behind the curtain sort of person. But yeah.
You know, let's have Denzel do it. After Gladiator 2, I want him to be in every movie. And how do you think today's Academy would receive this movie?
I think it would do fairly well. I'm thinking back, I guess, most to Barbie. I know that's just because she was inspired by this movie, and that didn't necessarily do well to the Oscars anyway. But I think for something that is visually striking, one that hits with most audiences and has great performances, I honestly think maybe more of the performances would be nominated today, but it would probably do, I would say, fewer nominations, but still get attention. How do you think it would do?
I think it would do fairly well. I agree. I think there's a world where we can see maybe this not getting as many acting nominations or getting into adapted screenplay or things like that, because musicals sometimes do tend to struggle in writing, or if it's, you know, a populist film, if it's something that families like or has a bend that way, we probably wouldn't see a director nomination. But I think this would still do really well in the crafts, especially and in those song and score categories. Absolutely. I think, too, now the Academy is, you know, a bit more open to adventurous out there films. I don't think Everything Everywhere All at Once comes close to what The Wizard of Oz achieves, but there is that zaniness and that artifice that's there that I do think the Academy can respond to. And Barbie, I think, is a good example of that as well. You can also look at something like Dune as this adventure epic, genre epic. They tend to embrace those more, I think, today. So I feel like it would still do pretty well.
And maybe we talk about Wicked a little bit in that it's an adaptation of a musical, and this was an adaptation of a book. And I think those worlds are similar. Like what we've seen and heard from Wicked so far is that maybe the cinematography is off, but they did build this setup by hand. So it's all real. It's practical. Some of it will be CGI. But I think it's a movie that is surprising me and how practical it is trying to be. And that's what The Wizard of Oz was. And it was so spectacular for that. So I'm curious if they'll appreciate Wicked in the same way that maybe we think of The Wizard of Oz now. Again, the Oscars, I think, were different. But all of those texts, like you mentioned, I think we will see with Wicked as well. Possibly some acting, possibly even Best Picture, where The Wizard of Oz was too. How do you think about that connection?
Yeah, I mean, I think with Wicked, I am really excited for our conversation in a few weeks about it. You know, it's also like it's adapted from a musical, but the musical is also adapted from a book. The book is just much different and very strange. I'm in the process of actually reading it right now because I was thinking about our episode coming up and I thought, oh my God, you guys are such like musical theater people and have seen it more, so I'm going to bring the book knowledge to that conversation. But yeah, I think from what we've heard so far, and obviously take this with a grain of salt because early reactions tend to be very positive about these movies, but people are loving it. I just read an IndieWire article today where Anne Thompson was comparing the reaction at the Academy screening to Oppenheimer, and that people were reacting to it in that way and having a lot of praise. So I think that we're in that time of year where we don't have a front runner. So people are going to make comparisons like that and, you know, read into all of these reactions. And they're looking for that big end of year spectacle and big end of year movie. But I think with the crafts, I mean, we've talked about this for a little while with our predictions, but I have this in costume design, production design. I think makeup and hairstyling make sense. I think visual effects. It's also a musical, so a sound nomination could happen. You have all of those things. And then if you're racking up below the line, I also, you can see this on our website, I put Ariana Grande in number 5 in supporting actress because she's the performance people are talking about. She wouldn't be the first Ariana from a musical in supporting actress to win this decade even. But I'm not saying winner. I'm just saying I think a nomination can absolutely happen. It's a big role. And I don't know. I think we'll have a better idea when we see it. But just based on the reactions so far, I think it'll be hanging around for a bit.
Yeah, I'm optimistic about it. I think just in viewing the movie, but also with nominations. So yeah, we will see very soon with that one. Our final question, if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
This was really, I think, a hard one because I wanted to, I don't know, I was just thinking like, okay, the music is something that has really, you know, stood out and stood the test of time. Maybe I'll go there. But really, I'm going to go with art direction for Cedric Gibbons and William A. Horning. I think that the art direction and the look of Kansas and Oz and the Emerald City, that's what we think of when we think of The Wizard of Oz. For me, at least, it's seeing those muted tones in Kansas. And then when we get to Oz, when those ruby slippers are put on her feet and she's on the yellow brick road, we see those trees and the flying monkeys. Like, that's all part of the art direction. And I think, again, there really being no question that this is a dream world for her and that it does have that artificial quality where, with those painted backdrops and the miniatures, that's something that we just don't see as much of anymore. So when we do see it in a film, I love it so much. And I feel like, for me, it's what I always will think of when I think of this movie. So I'm going to go art direction. What about you?
I'm going with that as well. I was thinking through even for Judy Garland, would I give it to her? But it is the look of the movie that trumps everything else, I think. It's, yes, the music is there, and like we talked about, there are multiple songs that have endured the test of time, but it's the shiny emerald of Emerald City. It's the yellow brick road. It's so many iconic things that I would think of first when I think of that movie, and it's a look that many filmmakers look to as well for inspiration, so I think that speaks for itself.
So that was our episode celebrating the 85th anniversary of The Wizard of Oz. Go watch it. Highly recommend a physical media purchase for this one if you don't have it. Otherwise, it is available to stream on Max right now. Next time on Oscar Wilde, we'll be reviewing a brand new release, Gladiator 2. This is, of course, the follow-up to Ridley Scott's Best Picture winner, Gladiator. I'm excited to talk about this one.
I'm excited for this, too, partly because it's a part of this new Barbenheimer called Glicked, which is funny seeing Paul Mescal say in interviews, but I think it's a movie that a lot of people have been waiting for, so I'm curious what people think, and I'm excited to chat about it. Thank you all for listening. Feel free to rate, review, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Oscar Wilde Pod. Also, our bonus content at patreon.com/OscarWilde. And updated nomination predictions on our website at oscarwilde.squarespace.com.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.